G'day miners, this is Peter Finn. Welcome to Full Production.
In this podcast, Pete talks everything mining.
A podcast dedicated to the mining industry in the Australian Pacific region.
From production to development, and most importantly, employment opportunities of the industry's biggest project. And here is your host, Peter Finn.
G'day guys, welcome to episode number 38 of Full Production with today's guest, a very smart bloke by the name of John Player from Mine Geotech. Was lucky enough to catch up with John a number of times through a few social and networking circles, so I was happy to be able to get him on the podcast to be able to pick his brain. John Player, welcome to Full Production, mate.
Thanks, Pete.
You only pulled out of me once.
Yes. Oh, well.
Plenty of good reasons behind it, I'm sure.
Yep, all good things come to those who wait.
Thanks for coming on, because I know me and you have met a couple of times now, and we've had some pretty stimulating conversations.
Yep.
Plenty of hot air, plenty of agreements and disagreements, mostly all in your favour. Due to your brains. What I want to talk about is obviously what you're currently doing now with Mine Geotech, so people know who you are. Yep. And what you're about.
Okay, so Mine Geotech is a geotechnical and mining engineering consultancy. We've been around for 7 years. Principally, we provide senior geotechnical engineers to mine sites, underground operations and open pit operations, and also undertake geotechnical feasibility studies through from for feasibility, pre-fee, scoping level, and also provide mining engineers to do reserve examination, essentially.
Yeah. How many staff you got currently?
So
mate?
We're up to 16 of us at the moment. A few of them are part-time. It is hard getting people these day and ages, so most of the part-timers are actually part-time because they have young kids.
Yeah.
To care for. And so to me, it's about the person, and then you identify the person, you employ them, you then structure the work around what hours they are able to work. And so that's the way I've always run the business, and the intention to continue running the business in that way.
Do you find your retention rate for them sort of quality people, where often that flexibility is good from a work output and quality point of view, as well as servicing your clients' needs?
Yeah, we've only lost one senior over the 7 years that the company has been running for.
Yeah, it's a good
so
night,
our,
mate.
Our turnover is a bit higher on the lower staff and admin staff, but yeah, the rest is the seniors are pretty consistent.
Yeah, and it's obviously a hard skill set to come across, which is something we'll talk about what you guys do from an investment point of view into the future.
Definitely a skill set that takes a lot of training.
And it's a topic of conversation around these. You know, I talk a lot about the diesel fitters and electricians because I need them. Yeah. But, you know, once again, they're only around because we have the mining engineers and all the other guys up top that are, you know, setting the mine sites up to be able to be operational.
Yeah, the skill sets to be – well, whether you're being practical with your hands or whether you're actually thinking for a living, you need that background behind you, and you either need to have got that background through, for a fitter, just going down the hole, fixing that loader, fixing that bogger, fixing that drill, or if you're going to be an engineer, it is, still having that raw experience for geotechs of logging core, going underground, doing the mapping, look at the pit walls for an open pit application, understanding what decisions you're making with regards to the rock mass, and then seeing that through with how the rock mass is actually behaving and understanding why you've made that decision, the implications from it, and then the outcomes from it.
Spoken from a man with plenty of experience and walked the path, I take it, mate, by the sounds of them words.
Yes, I've seen, the industry is a lot different from when I started. So what used to be acceptable practices in the 80s and 90s are no longer acceptable practices. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff happen over the years.
And let's get into your background and your story, because I think it's really important. I try to get people's backgrounds and story in play to the conversations I have, because it paints the full picture to how you get to your position today. So growing up, you're a cane toad, mate, a Queenslander. I'm a New South Wales Welshman, so
born in New South Wales.
Yep. Oh, very good.
In Wollongong.
Yep. You're born on the right side of the fence then, mate.
Yep, but we moved to Queensland when I was 2.5, and I was raised in Mount Isa, in Western Queensland, a strong mining town. But on my family side, we're from a long line of coal mining deputies on my mother's side. So my grandfather, his father, and his father were all coal mining deputies.
Wollongong area?
In Wollongong. And my great-great-grandfather brought the first dewatering pumps to Australia.
Wow.
So, yeah, a long mining's been in the blood for a long time.
Especially in the coal mining game. I've done a bit of work in Sunnybargo and Tarmore and Westcliff. I think, I don't know if their mines have been around for a long time in Wollongong. This is many years ago. But the rich family history in them areas of Wollongong run pretty deep as a prime example.
Yeah, it's interesting. Coal didn't have a big attraction to me. Being raised in Mount Isa, it was metalliferous and different layouts of mines, different styles of mining. But Christmas vacation was down to Wollongong, 3 days drive.
Yep.
With the family in the back of a combi van. And see the ocean, see the mountains, see the rainforest, which is what we don't get up at Mount Isa. But it's
not a short drive, mate. 3 days.
No, but progressively over the years, the trip between Mount Isa and Townsville got physically shorter,
yeah,
as the bends in the road got straightened out. When we first moved to Mount Isa, the roads weren't tar. All the roads were dirt. So during the wet season, you got rained into Mount Isa, and there were a number of summers that we didn't leave when we expected to leave because the roads were washed out. So we would wait till the roads to dry out and then head off on Christmas holidays.
So you've definitely seen a mining town like Mount Isa evolve. We'll probably get in that through your story. But why did your mum and dad move from Wollongong to Mount Isa?
Yeah, so dad's a metallurgist, and he would in Wollongong he was working in the blast furnaces, the iron ore furnaces. So his PhD was in pyrometallurgy, in that technology. And so the only pyrometallurgy going at the time was the blast furnaces of Wollongong, where he'd already worked, or there was the lead smelters and copper smelters in Mount Isa. Or in the early 70s, this is 73, 74, there may have been the nickel smelter in Kambalda, maybe. So there wasn't a lot of
around.
Yeah, not a lot of options. So we ended up in Mount Isa. And they were there for 21 years.
Yeah, and you got sisters and brothers as well?
Yep, younger brother and a younger sister.
Who's smarter?
We're all smart. We're all smart in different ways. So okay. My sister is a mining engineer as well.
Not working for you, mate.
Yeah, and she's working for me, doing the reserve work. And my brother is a writer, actor in Brisbane.
Very diverse.
Yeah, it is.
Well, a little bit anyway.
But I suppose, I think we all have those components of us. We've all got varying degrees of art and engineering, and there's definitely an argument that there's relationships between art and engineering.
Yeah. Was your dad disappointed there was no metallurgist?
No, he just wanted us all to enjoy what we do.
He would have gave his all a fair bit of exposure growing up in Mount Isa to the variety of fields that are options to you guys growing up in a mining town. I know growing up in Cobar, it gave me a vast amount of options from, you know, going to university to doing a trade to going actually mining and vice versa. So I presume growing up in Mount Isa, how was life? Was it good? And
Mount Isa growing up in the 1970s is definitely, and the early 80s is definitely different to what Mount Isa is like now. So it is, in the 1970s, it's a single company town. It's hard to get in and out of. Kids roam the street. My brother and I would go down to the creek, ride our bikes into the creek, muck around, play cricket. It was awesome. Just did our own stuff and the kids just hang out on the streets and did kids kind of things. But I guess it's not something which you necessarily see around anymore, perhaps to the detriment of our society.
Social media?
Yeah, well, there was none of that in the 1970s. Yeah. I think mobile phone and internet, so definitely not late 90s and early 2000s, and I'd been working for a few years before those things
came up. I remember they came, I was in high school and they came through, obviously a bit younger. I remember them clearly. So grew up obviously pretty normal sort of Mount Isa lifestyle.
Very much so. Ride the bike everywhere, play cricket during the middle of summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would have been a pretty big rugby league town too, I'd say, wouldn't it, Mount Isa?
Yeah. No, I wasn't into the
not missing nothing, mate, there, mate. Not a very smart game at times. So from there, you went to high school, and I guess as you become into high school, you become a bit more self-aware and start looking at life a little bit differently. Did you have any ambitions to what you were going to do when you finished high school and, you know, through them years?
Yeah, so, well, from high school, I found parts of high school quite challenging. I enjoyed photography. I was also really good at biology and chemistry. And so I was keen to go to university and do genetic engineering, because it was actually at the cusp of, in the late 80s, was the cusp of genetic engineering. It was how we were going to fix the world's food problems, how we were going to modify essentially the DNA to remove diseases. And they were two of my great subjects. So I thought, yep, that's what I'm off to university to do.
How'd your marks go, mate?
Almost failed first year. I got through by one. So I was 17 for all my first year at university.
Gee, you're young.
Yeah. 2,500 kilometres away from home. Yeah. So, yeah, a challenge. And I was a smart kid at high school.
Did you finish high school early, or did you were young for your year?
I was. My birthday's in December, and so I was young for the year. So in Queensland, your entrance, you can actually be through to January the year after, and still enter that year. Whereas in WA, it's mid year, so August goes one way and July goes the other way. Which made me a young high school student, young university student. And so, although, I was bright at high school, but found exams difficult, but university just didn't have the study techniques. And so found the first year, particularly exams, I found difficult. All through my university, I found exams difficult. Found projects really good.
Did you find alcohol supplies all right?
Not so much in first year.
No. Okay. And as you evolved, you obviously turned 18 and getting in more into the uni lifestyle, I take it after the first year you started to find your feet and get a bit of momentum?
Yeah, not so much just university, but just finding an outcome. So first year engineering is very broad, somewhat nondescript, a lot of background, maths, chemistry, physics, huge classes, 300, 400 student classes. I'm used to a class of high 20s. Yeah. And so that's such a big cultural shock to me. Yeah. So then changed to mining engineering. Or at the end of first year, you then make a decision.
So you change your flavour, mate.
Changed. So I got vocation work at Mount Isa. Mm-hmm. Did secondary blast.
Yep.
Started underground on my 18th birthday.
So you've chosen your flavour of engineering.
Yeah.
There.
So, well, I got vocation work. I was lucky to get secondary blast. Started underground on my 18th birthday. So essentially as soon as it was legal, I started working underground. And me and another guy, we just spent the entire vacation break running around blowing up rocks, and it was absolutely fucking fantastic. And that's what we did. So we were the Mad Bombers of X-41, and so we just went and blew rocks up, and so that was great. So, and then I think also then did some time at magazine maintenance as well. But that was good physical work. It was.
Does that stimulate you to keep on going?
Well, I suppose it was also immediate reward. You did something and you got some money for it. There wasn't much money those days as a student, but it sort of gave me direction. And so that then went, yep, I'll do mining engineering, which then was smaller class sizes, stuff I was immediately familiar with. I knew the terminology, I knew how things worked, and it just connected to me. And so, I could do mining engineering. And so even when I was doing mining engineering, my marks got progressively better through year. I found exams difficult the entire way through university, but I did good projects.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just the way my head works. That short turnaround time of being able to recall and write something down doesn't gel with me, but give me
something
time
practical
to think about it. Well, even just time to think about it and actually analyze and collect the data together, and you'll get something pretty exceptional.
So that's the first degree, mate, because you ended up going on and doing more later on in life.
Yeah.
You finish university. And you end up going to the surface, I recall, from our conversation
the
other day.
So I finished uni over 5 years because of first year. Enjoyed the rest of university, was part of AusIMM, did some astronomy courses along the way, which was a nice bit of diversity, and then graduated in 93. house interest rates were 18%.
Wow.
Australia was having the recession we had to have.
Yeah.
And there was no work. So I think it was my 12th or 13th job interview was the one that I got.
Well, you had a few then.
Yeah, but that was what it was at the time. And there wasn't that many mining engineering graduates. There just wasn't a lot of work going.
Where did you end up?
So I ended up in Mount Lachlan in Charters Towers.
So you got to stay in Queensland. How far is Charters from Mount Isa? Is that obviously mum and dad and family still in Mount Isa?
700K. Yeah.
Okay. So you had family in Mount Isa still as well?
Yeah, so my brother was at uni at the time and, parents and sister was in Mount Isa.
Cool.
Yeah.
That was an open cut, was it?
Yeah, so Mount Lachlan ended up being quite a big open cut. And so I was there for 3 years and nominally to start a graduate program, but ended up sort of doing the drill and blast and then doing the... That had an affinity to drill and blast. I sort of did a lot of drill and blast as part of my undergraduate course,
yep.
Both as my thesis as well as during my vacation work. And then the Mount Lachlan was open pit drill and blast, and then also got into final wall drill and blast, so responsible for the pre-splitting and the trim shots, which then also got had the prisms allocated to it and dewatering holes for that pit were 120 meter long RC holes that we punched in horizontally off the side of the pit.
Yep.
And then the cable bolting got added to that, and then the why were the pit walls falling in got added to that. And so as a graduate with 2 years experience, why are our 100 meter high pit walls falling in is a steep,
steep learning curve.
Yeah,
and I take it obviously the jobs were hard to come by, which probably made you even more keen to make sure you're delivering on your work fronts. Did you have good mentors as well?
I had a good mentor. So my site manager Jeff was excellent. So just that to have support from an old engineer in that to tell you what's happening behind the scenes as well as what you're seeing. Up front is a high degree of trust and I guess a high degree of care as well. And that was highly motivating. So I worked exceptionally hard because I was given that responsibility.
Did you find yourself doing that to other people or younger people when you went up the ranks yourself?
I've tried to. I guess I haven't really been in that position because I've just generally worked as a drill and blast engineer or geotech and then worked through as went back to university for an extended period of time and then I've been running my own company. So we haven't quite had the same relationship. So I haven't worked in that site technical services role.
You obviously look back pretty fondly on Jeff then.
Hmm. Yep.
It's good when you find good people that are willing to, you know, put their hand out for you. Might not remember everything they said, but you always remember how they made you feel. And that's obviously what Jeff did to you. So from there, you moved on and went back to university?
So I did 3 years of open cut and then my partner at the time decided to move across to WA.
Yep.
And a job came up over here. So I got a transfer with Normandy to cross to Big Bell to be a drill and blast engineer for the underground. And so I started doing that. I ended up being at Big Bell for 6 years,
cool.
During which time I transitioned from doing the drill and blast to also doing the geotech as well. And that was at a time like the 90s, there wasn't really, gold was $280 an ounce compared to...
What is my price up there? I've got a shirt now.
5.8 billion.
That's what I'm worth.
So, gold was 280 US an ounce, whereas now it's 1200 US an ounce. So, gold mining in the late 90s was hard.
I wasn't worth that much back in the late 90s, mate.
But the way we learnt geotech then was very much on the job geotech. There were almost no undergraduate courses and there were very few master's courses.
Did you have some good teachers at? All good mentors at Big Bell.
Yes, so I learned my geotech from Mike Sandy of AMC. And so I started the geotech because I knew Mike from my vacation work at Mount Isa.
Yep.
I was also into the geotech side because I learned from my open pit stuff what was limiting my drill and blast knowledge was my rock mechanics knowledge. I needed to know more about the geology to actually improve my drill and blast patterns. because I could see that was where the weakness of my understanding was. So I learned more about the geology, more about the rock, because it's the rock we deal with. It's not all concrete. It's not all plasticine. It's the structure to think about. So
your mindset started to shift around how you were doing things
as well? Yeah, well, it had already shifted during open cut, but it sort of, as part of when I was doing underground, it became more geotech emphasis. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it more, but I was doing both the drill and blast role and the geotech role. What I found, though, was that the Big Bell was a very difficult mine. We were highly seismic. We had a couple of fatalities due to rock falls. It was difficult. We were applying the best that we understood at the time, but it wasn't good enough. And you sort of always get taught, do your best and it'll be fine. But in that case, doing your best wasn't sufficient.
I think we've had this conversation offline about this is when you started to realize you wanted to do some more do some more education or better yourself to be able to broaden your horizons.
Yeah. So I realized, through what we were seeing underground with how the ground support systems were behaving, I could see that the general rules that we applied in the mining industry weren't sufficient. The way we were calculating the capacity of the reinforcement systems wasn't correct. We needed to do more. I needed to do more work, but also as an industry, we needed to do more dynamic testing to get the correct loading and capability of the ground support scheme. So my first bit was to go to West Australian School of Mines and to do their master's course there. And so that was the master's course that Professor Villascusa was running. And that was the block release course where we would go to Kalgoorlie for two sets of 3 weeks in the beginning and midway through the year. And we would do, essentially, you do work straight through for 3 weeks where you would do 4 days of a subject, have an exam, have the afternoon off, 4 days of a subject, have an exam, have the afternoon off, 4 days, and you just work straight through for that process. So that was the master's course. And then once I'd done the coursework content, I found we'd got to the point where I needed my thesis, and the thesis was to build a new novel dynamic testing facility.
How many pages, mate?
So that was, it was only supposed to be 6 months. And so I did it for 6 months. We couldn't find anyone to take over. And so I decided to take it over as my PhD.
You dug deeper and deeper into it.
Which meant I then had to write up something to be my master's. So I then wrote up all my Big Bell experiences, my master's. And that was just to fill the gap so I could get my master's, so I could then enroll to do my PhD. So that ended up being, I think it was 350 pages for my master's on Big Bell, accumulating all that, our Big Bell knowledge. And then my PhD has ended up being 498 or something. But it went for a long time, perhaps it did go for a long time, perhaps a little bit too long, but there was a lot to learn along the way.
Was there a good sense of fulfillment when you got there?
There was a sense of fulfillment all the way through, because we were publishing information along the way. We could see that the testing facility is unique. And for those that go to the Mine Geotech website, you can see a link to the testing facility that was on the ABC Science show. So that was good. So there's a video of our testing facility working and how we break steel bars essentially in the test facility, as well as other reinforcement systems. But that process of what we were doing, essentially our test facility is far more in similarity to military test facilities and civil test facilities than the other mining test facilities. As we were doing the research into what the facility should be, we decided essentially all the rest of the mining facilities were wrong. There was only one correct way to do it, and that was the way which we have done it, with the momentum transfer technique. So we can load and break and measure and analyze and work out the dynamic capability of reinforcement and support systems.
Plenty of beneficials come out of it then, mate.
Yeah, so we actually understand now, have a much higher understanding of reinforcement and support systems in terms of the capacity. We have built a very large library of support and reinforcement systems. So it's a very good index. Of how different systems behave. The mining industry has benefited from it. Suppliers have benefited from it by being able to make better rock bolts and better mesh. And the ground support schemes that we're now installing are significantly better, orders of magnitude improved on their dynamic capability compared to what used to be installed. So we can now we can now design, install, and we've validated it through some of the sponsors in Chile, where they're using our really advanced ground support schemes.
You're getting pretty deep in some part of them countries too.
Very deep, and also in the Andes, you've got very aggressive stress regimes. And at El Teniente, they've already taken out half a mountain through block caving, and so you get some really wicked high stresses at unusual orientations that just smash the excavations. And the new ground support schemes that have been developed by Professor Villascusa out of the project survive. They survive very big hits. Yep, very big hits at close locations.
Did it surprise you, some of the results you got?
In what way? Like nothing else previous was correct.
Yeah.
And so it was everything we did out there was good. It was important to the testing. Yeah, sure. Some results that were clearly being marketed on a wish and a prayer or a whim by some of the people that hadn't tested properly, or at least understood what they were doing, they were putting crap bolts into the market. We tested them, and now you won't find those bolts in the market anymore.
What sort of year are we talking now?
So this is 2002 through to 2012.
Okay. And has there been a rapid adjustment or evolvement of since 2012? Have you seen it change much more?
Yeah, there's still new bolts coming out to market. I guess the major bolt that's been major style of bolt that's come out recently is the point anchored split set.
Yeah. I think that's a whole other topic altogether, mate. The rabbit hole you go down there. Let's get back on your career.
Yeah.
Big bell mine.
Yeah.
Plenty of study in between. Did you, where were we living? Were you living in Cal or were you living?
So Big Bell was FIFO out of Perth.
Okay.
And days off were pretty much living in my consultant's office, learning how to be a geotech.
Yeah.
So that took care of all the, all of my late 20s. And then once Big Bell, after we had the major fatality in the mine, we went through a big mine redesign process. I took off for, I think I ended up taking 5 months off and just went backpacking around Africa.
Yeah, pretty refreshing, so, mate.
Yeah, it was definitely a shock to the system to come back to work, but it was just important to get away and look and explore and take a shitload of photos. And this is the days when photos were slide, not digital.
Yep.
So take a shitload of photos and just wander around and enjoy it.
Yeah,
and
good experience. Did you go by yourself?
Yeah, I just picked up a series of tour groups and then did stuff by myself in between. And then just, hung out with people I met along the way.
Spend all your money, mate. Good. Come back and do it all over again.
Well, again, late 90s, you didn't earn much money being a mining engineer. So, spent everything. If I'd actually sold the house that I had prior to leaving, I would have just kept going for another few months at least, because I didn't want to come back. It was far more enjoyable to travel and look and, see the history that's around.
A holiday that never ends, mate.
It was a holiday, but it was also – it was educational. Spent a lot of time in museums and art galleries and talking to people.
Did you choose Africa for any certain reason, or you just had a lot of interest there?
Well, the original idea was to actually do the full circuit of the Mediterranean, and so that's what I was trying to do. Like, Mediterranean is essentially the cradle of human society. Let's go for that instead. And a lot of the old cultures come from around that area, and – part of it was to help me understand why people believe what they believe, which is a big influence on why we do what we do. And just so I wanted to do the circuit, actually see what the old societies did, what the old cultures did, and what the similarities were between them. And essentially, the ideas are the same. They just keep coming through. There's not really, there's not a lot of new ideas. It's just regeneration of the same ideas over and over.
That's interesting. Bit of involvement there.
Perhaps. I guess it was my own personal approach to try and work out whether I had any religious belief or not.
Yep.
And so it was to try and understand what the old societies did.
Yeah, definitely not going to go down that rabbit hole, mate. So you've come back from your holiday rejuvenated. Where did life take John Player then?
That was beginning of my PhD. So that was 2001. Yeah, so then finished off my research, got into my got into the PhD. But doing a PhD in your 30s, there's essentially no money. Yep. So I needed to do contracting work during it. So that was good. So I got more geotechnical experience during that time. And essentially it was PhD during the week. And then during the weekends, I'd go out to one of the mines and be the geotechnical engineer over the weekend and then repeat. And did that for a while. And so that earned the money to keep my studies going. And
how do you look back on them times now?
It was hard work. It was hard work because there wasn't enough holidays. That's one disadvantage. There's no formal holidays account as part of a PhD. And yeah, I was working pretty much. I had every second weekend off, kind of. So it was just a lot of work, too many hours. Yeah. Interesting. Got to travel to a few conferences internationally.
Yeah.
Got to present in front of hundreds of people what my ideas were. So rewarding in that respect. But yeah, too big. A bit more funding, a bit more industry funding up front would have made it easier for us.
How did you go selling some ideas and concepts that you had to people that may have had a fixed mindset?
So present the data. Because we tested so much and we have the largest test database, it's just show the numbers. The numbers will speak for themselves rather than having these ideas of, oh, I'll bolster that, or I'll bolster that. Show me. When I was doing the lit review for it, we found PhDs that were granted on testing six bolts, not six types of bolts, six. For my PhD, we tested 220 bolts and 100 support elements, essentially mesh.
So plenty of data there, mate.
Exactly. Lots of data, lots of different types, lots of understanding of what was happening. And that whole approach of get the data, understand the data, understand the variance, understand the controls into the system, because everything is dictated by how you measure it. Your measurement influences your result. Your measurement influences the how things respond. You need to be able to understand your measurement system as well. So it was, yeah, it was an interesting process to work through on how we sold the idea. And it was simply, this is how we analyze it. We can actually track the energy. We can calculate the energy. We can obtain an energy balance. And we can show different types of performance for different types of reinforcement systems, which matched our observations to what we were seeing underground. Stuff that we rated better, performed better underground, than stuff that we rated lower.
When did you decide to get a full-time job, my friend? When did you finish? Did you finish obviously your PhD and the presentations and obviously all the fun stuff of probing ground support and conditions and all the other moving parts that come with it? There must have been obviously a moment where you go, well, I'm sick of working every weekend to cover my study.
So I suppose the PhD ultimately went for about 10 years all up between the initial build and which then got wrapped back into doing a master's and then back into PhD. So it finally took about 10 years. And I just had reached a point of finally got the PhD actually written up, but I didn't have it in me to keep doing. Well, I didn't want to keep doing what I was doing, which was 80% nominally towards the PhD studies and 20% towards my consulting or contracting. I wanted to flip that. I still wanted an association.
So you wanted 8 to 20 to be the other way around. Yeah,
and the only way I could achieve that was through my own company.
Okay. And that's how Mind Geotech
started up. I already had the company registered. I had ideas of, I spent all that time, also not spent all the time, but I had ideas during that process of, yes, I want to have my own company. These are my ideas of how I want it to function. So I had these 10 years of pre-thought about my company of where it would go to.
You've got a wealth of knowledge, mate. I'm just thinking about a PhD and I'm thinking, how much does guy actually know?
A lot.
Yeah.
So but it's like, I guess a lot of the things that they talk about, you know how much you know by how much you don't know. And that was really true. For dynamic testing, the more we understood, the less we understood. And we went through this, and we went through that really strong curve of, yeah, we really had to understand what was happening. And then we got over those hurdles of, and we could actually start explaining what was happening in our facility and how we could describe
it. A lot of manufacturers must have benefited from this study as well.
Yeah, the ones that sponsored us.
Yeah.
It was hard to get sponsorship, though.
Funding.
Early 2000s, the mining industry wasn't doing what it's doing. I was at study during all the time that the industry boomed. Where salaries doubled and tripled, I didn't see any of that. I was at my study doing my development. I had three great mentors, my direct supervisor, Professor Villasouza. I had also Dr. Alan Thompson and Chris Windsor, like three internationally renowned people with regards to ground support scheme design. So essentially I invested 10 years in myself, 10 years of learning and honing my skills with regards to ground support design and geotechnical engineering. And so you have that knowledge, you need to apply it. And so the best way I could see to apply it was through my own consultancy and passing my knowledge and passing my thought processes into the way which MGT approaches our jobs.
How are you guys going today? So you kicked it off. You're a one-man band, I take it, when you first started.
So it was just one of us initially, me, and then we've got up to being 18.
Did you realise how advanced you were when you came into the market, flipping from the 80-20, actually concentrating on working in 20, you know, being back on the – we talk about the scholarships and all that stuff in a little bit, but, you know, when you started to get involved in operations?
So I guess the first part of what I wanted to achieve was I had some holes in my knowledge, and so I targeted operations where I could pick up those gaps. So I worked two jobs back-to-back, being single at the time. I did block cave and deformable ground to get deformable ground knowledge. Sorry, sublevel cave and deformable ground to get deformable ground knowledge.
And where was that at, mate?
That was at Maggie Hayes.
Yep.
And I did a mine that was running paste fill just so I could get paste fill experience. They had ground support issues as well. And I actually deliberately stayed away from doing seismic stuff because I had just done 10 years of seismic ground support design and testing.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get into seismic.
Yeah.
I just needed a break away from it. And so, but yeah, that's changed now. I'm back into doing seismic stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so potentially pick up those knowledge gaps and progress. But there's always things to learn. And it's the nice thing about mining and the nice thing about engineering. There's always new areas to explore to improve your knowledge of what's happening if you have a passion for the field.
Yeah, you must have a lot of guys that are probably on the phone to you a bit, mate, or engaging your services for the reasons of how much knowledge you do have. Do you find it sometimes difficult to – how can I explain this? Do you find it difficult sometimes to translate it to a format where people understand it? Because I know I've heard you speak sometimes and I've just gone – yeah, I've got no fucking idea what you just said, John. It sounded really good and I sort of get the concept, but the depth of it is extreme.
It is easy to I'm trying to the right way to answer it. So if you can't explain your ideas, it's actually you that's at fault.
Yep.
You have to be able to explain appropriate to your audience. Whether your audience is the jumbo operator that's installing the bolts and doesn't want to put this resin bolt into broken ground because it's fucking difficult. Yep, that's fine. The reason why we're going to do it is because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Or it reaches a point where, it's too difficult and we're now going to change reinforcement systems and we're going to do this. So whether it's explaining that or whether it's explaining to the underground manager or whether it's explaining to the DMP inspector, you've got to be able to target at the right level.
How much reinvestment do you do personally into your own team? Because obviously now you've got a team, and me and you have spoken about this, because sometimes they're not talking to John himself personally, that they shouldn't still not get the same standard of work.
So all my seniors have a training allowance. I want them all to use their training allowance, and then everything we write goes through our internal peer review process. And essentially all the projects, I work on my engineers with them as well. So there's a little bit of John's love sprinkled around everywhere.
You're seeing some real benefits from that as well?
Yeah, it's, well, their development, my development, because I want my engineers to challenge the way that I think as well. I will challenge them as well. Because if they have an idea, they've got to convince me. They need to show me the data as to why it's correct. And if it's correct, I got no problem supporting it.
I guess you don't want them to be intimidated either. You want them to come up and
Oh, no, it's not a point about being aggressive in your point of view. It's simply about you just need to show me the data to support your idea. If you've got the data, I really want to see it because...
Have you been impressed by some of the stuff that's been put in front of you? Have you had someone that's wowed you?
Oh, all my seniors have. They all bring something to the table. They've all got different sets of experience. They've all been trained differently. They've all seen different things. All my seniors have 10 years experience. They've all got a master's degree. If you get a senior from Mind Geotech, that's what you're getting. You're getting someone that's actually experienced, that's been around, that can solve your problems. And that's what I expect them to be able to do. In some respect, my views are quite traditional. I find it hard to see these consultancies that they'll have 10 different levels of engineers coming through. We have graduates, engineers, seniors, and principals. That's it. You sort of don't need so many different levels coming through. I think that's the right number of positions to actually get back to where being a senior meant something. Being a senior wasn't someone with 4 years experience, which is what we definitely saw during the boom. It got used as a title to be able to attract people, whereas it should mean something.
100% just mean something, especially with the guys that are starting to probably add value to other people's work fronts. It must make you feel better knowing that you've got these people around as well.
We always must add value. As a consultant or a contractor, if you're not adding value to your client, you need to get out of their mind. And you can either add value by improving their processes or by validating what they're doing or by making improvements to their ground support systems or changing their mining method and fixing their mining method or improving their QAQ systems that actually mean that they then can reduce their cement content in the paste, but actually explaining to them why they can reduce their cement content in the paste is because their paste is actually coarse and they can reduce the amount of cement because the binders work more effectively. So there's a whole range of things that need to be done, but it's that ongoing discussion, that having that discussion with your clients to be able to reach what the final decision is. A great little one is a little pit we did for a little company, Empire. And there, the pit was a challenging pit. It is one side of the pit was essentially clay and wet clays. The other side of the pit was essentially fresh rock. And we got that pit down to the bottom. It fell in a few times along the way, but not as much as what we thought it would be. But the whole design of the pit was based on very open conversations. If we make it too flat, you don't make any money. So let's make it steep and recognize that risk in the design and actually design it so that we have contingency if there is failure so that we can still work with the failures. And so the process went through of actually having what we ended up with was that it's steep above the haul road. We made the haul road extra width so we could still traffic past it if it fell onto the haul road. We also had a fleet size change as well. So big fleet, when there was high material strip rates, that could also be used for the if a failure if it did occur, which didn't occur above the haul road, not significantly above the haul road. And then underneath the haul road, it got much flatter, where the fleet size got smaller because we had to be more conservative for it and we could sort of fix it to get round to the bottom. So we ended up going from 150-ton trucks down to six-wheeler trucks.
Wow.
Was the step change in fleet because of the pit geometry changes. And a really interesting little project. But that was all because we had very open discussions with the client about this is our understanding of the rock. This is where we can save you some money by taking these extra risks. This is what these extra risks mean to you and mean to the project. And it worked. But it's a journey you've got to take with your client. You can't just dictate to your client, oh, we're going to do this. It's like, no, this is... It's their mind. You've got to help them to make these decisions.
Lead the horse to water, you can't make it drink.
Yeah.
How can someone who's listening to this podcast, who probably wants to be good at what they do, and I presume you have positions vacant because your desired skill set is pretty high at the moment in this current mining market, what are you looking for, mate, at the moment? Is there any positions out there you have got vacant within Mind Geotech?
So I would consider a talented young graduate, so someone with a couple of years' experience. I've always interested in senior geotechnical engineers, and by senior, that's my definition of senior. So 10 years experience with a master's degree, that's a senior. If you've got those levels of experience, or if you're a talented mining engineer, we are expanding our mining engineering side because people like what we do as a geotech. We do bring a different view to geotech because of our mining background to it. We always consider the mining, so that's...
What do some, most mines or other mines classify as senior these days? You're saying 10 years.
Yeah, five.
Five. It's changing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's been five since the big iron ore boom.
Yeah, okay.
When all the bodies got sucked out of the industry and so seniors got promoted too early.
You're doing more as well by giving back to Queensland University. We talked about it before the podcast.
University of Queensland managed to see me through my engineering degree, so that's one of the institutions that we as a company support. So we support two of the University of Queensland programs. They have an Aspire scholarship, and so we're one of several Aspire scholarship sponsor companies. And so that's for 2 years for $4,500, and it's for first years only that are entering a STEM course, so science, technology, engineering, maths. But our particular requirement was that the student comes from remote or regional Australia and are going to University of Queensland. So that was, so that helped, that $4,500 goes towards books and courses and takes that, a lot of that emphasis on getting that first year money in where you've got to set yourself up when you're away from home particularly.
Do you got a few stories of success or people that you've got? You've been doing it for a few years now.
So Aspire, we've only just started doing. Okay. It's a new program, and it's also as part of, as the mine geotechs become more successful, we try to put more money back in as part of that development. And it's STEM, so it's not just mining. It is development into education, essentially. Our first one that we have sponsored through University of Queensland is the Young Achievers Program. And so that started in 2009, and we started sponsoring that probably in 2011, maybe 2012. And the YAP program targets students from disadvantaged backgrounds at year 10 level. It shows them a pathway through to university and then supports them going into university.
So you're getting them early.
Yeah, and again, and the YAP program is anything. It doesn't matter what they decide to study. It is supporting into education, essentially, because it's only through education that you can make a difference, really. And then the other side that we choose sponsor is the Smith Family Education for Life program, and we sponsor three students in that.
Good to know I had to prompt you on it because the amount of knowledge in your head, I'm surprised you have any more space to be able to process everything.
It's, it does overflow.
It does, yeah. Mate. And I think that people like you giving back to institutes like that and people, it's a must for us as an industry to be looking after and making us
absolutely
attractive.
So there's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of discussion in the industry about how do we get more students staying within the industry? How do we get them in? And yep, you can target mining directly in second, third or fourth year, but it's too late. You need to go earlier. And that's how we chose the programs that we chose. And I guess also a bit more general. We need people going, advancing their education. So that was why I chose the programs that I went for.
It's interesting you say when we should be targeting and how we should be targeting. When you pulled out of me yesterday, I grabbed my operations manager who looks after my labour hire and training side of things, Wade Greenwood, and Wade's actually a boilermaker by trade and became a TAFE teacher and then became a deputy principal. And I asked him, and me and him are talking about we're starting to employ apprenticeships now through FACE and traineeships and become an RTO and all this sort of stuff. And I sort of said to him, when do you think we should be starting to target people? And he's a big believer of year 7, year 8, like getting them early, and you know, year 10, same sort of thing. When they're starting to become aware of what they're here for and what options are in front of
particularly
them.
Particularly if a student thinks they're going to go to university, they've got to do the right courses to get into it. So there's no point targeting at university. You've already missed all the population that decided mining wasn't for them, or engineering wasn't for them, or science wasn't for them. And we need more science, technology, engineering, mathematics in Australia. It's as simple as that. Whether they go into mining, mining is only part of it. We're going to need more electricians. We're going to need more computer people. We're going to need more IT people. Mines are getting smarter. The technology,
the variety of roles
is getting
too
faster. The variety of roles is getting stronger. So to only invest in mining is limiting. We need to invest across the board in our education system. And companies that are dependent on that should be doing it.
Yeah, I'm biased. I really want the kids to come mining. This is why I got a podcast, because I'm trying to look at different formats, and obviously being younger, I'm trying to resonate with them and however I can get their attention to say, hey, this is why you should come to mining. This is what it gives you. And I know we're all talking about sustainability, and I guess a lot of that stuff's out of people's hands. You've got to be adaptable to the market. But I'm excited to see what it comes from this investment that people like yourself make into the future.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's we'll only see through time and, yeah, and it is time. It will be they're long-term investments. So we will now continue to do these programs with the University of Queensland until Mind Geotech no longer around, which will be, I don't know.
Not your lifetime, mate.
not my lifetime. It's here to stay. So, yeah, it's support of the education process, support of students. So we also support stuff like the WA Ground Control Group, which is essentially an informal association of geotechnical professionals in West Australia. So we sponsor their events, and that's the other end once you're actually industry and working. And we also sponsor like the Was and Wombats and Was and Wallabies. So, and my only condition there is when they travel is that they go see mine sites, because visiting mine sites when you're a mining engineer is bloody awesome, because you just get to see these different processes, different mining methods, different installations, different geology, different milling streams, different people, different languages, different everything. And so when you are a student and you, well, for the mining students that are listening to this, go on international field trips, go to lots of mines, listen to what they say, look at what they're doing and learn stuff, because they're really good value.
I think there's probably a lot of people I could probably, you can introduce me to as well, that could probably come on the podcast and add plenty of value of different fields and input, which is something that I'm trying to get a variety on the podcast with, because as you just said, everything from a diesel fitter right through to a metallurgist to whatever could float your boat, an IT person. Definitely something that I'm keen to tap into further. Now, before we go down any more rabbit holes, we're going to try and wrap it up, because I know your phone's probably rang really hot in the last hour that I've had you on the podcast. So what makes you nervous about the mining industry?
At the moment, it is definitely our shortage of people. So although that's a benefit to my company in that we've got lots to work on, it's also a shortage to the industry. We don't have the skill sets to we're short on skill sets to be able to develop the mines of the future. There's just not the experience required to run them design them.
It's a common theme, isn't it?
Yep.
It's a common conversation we're having week in, week out.
Yep. I think part of that is mining engineering is a really interesting course and profession. There's quite a split in the profession where people decide and run more, head down more of the managerial route, or you end off being a technical side. And so they are two different types of people. There's a lot of specialization in the technical side of mining, which you don't necessarily see in the other fields. Particularly where you move into stuff like geotech, it has a very high proportion of people that go on to extra study, because you just need to do that to actually understand your niches within that field. And so that technical content, mines are technical, they are challenging, they're going to continue to get more so the deeper we go, and being able to mine safely and cost effectively is what it comes down to. We're not here to mine for love, we've got to mine for profit. But we can't do it and kill people at the same time. So we've got to be able to get the right shapes, the right ground support schemes, the right mining methods, the right fill systems to control the rock mass response.
Are people approaching that topic early or too late, or mining companies in general? What are you seeing as a trend?
It depends what their association is. If they haven't worked in heavy seismic conditions before, then there's almost no connection that what they're going to get is potentially seismic, unless they have someone that's dealt with it and it always sits at the front of their head that, yes, what we're doing, if we don't do it right, we can cause ourselves a lot of problems.
You get a lot of work pushed your way before they get to that point? You know, people coming to see you about that topic or topics like that?
No, it very much goes through waves of whether there's issues in the industry or not.
Yeah. Let's talk about what makes you excited about the industry.
That we are picking up again, that there is some really interesting projects happening, that there is a lot of technology uptake, that we are looking at remote technology. Remotes won't be the answer to everything, though. We still need people to go down the hole.
An awesome event last night at the Celtic Club, and they had Sandvik there. Crazy. Yep. Crazy some of the things that, you know, if people do a mine design right, you know, you've obviously got to do a fair bit of design work, and obviously it depends on your ore body, and some pretty cool stuff out there. That's just as an example.
Yeah. The technology that we're deploying, but we have to deploy that technology because essentially ore bodies are getting lower grade over time and they're getting deeper. And so the only way we can mine them cost effectively is through technology. And you look at the technology changes that we've had in mining over the last 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, are huge. And so that they will continue rolling out in those processes where the technology improves the industry.
It relates back to obviously improving production on mine sites, yep, and obviously the reinvestment in people to get them smarter, wiser, trained
hopefully
up.
The reinvestment of people is not something the industry does well. It is a challenge that I don't know why we don't do investment in our people well, because we have significant operations that have significant life that don't invest or don't employ graduates every year. And when you have a 20-year mine life or a 30-year mine life or a 40-year mine life, you should be employing graduates every year. It's just what you need to do.
It's a whole nother deep thought of, for me personally, perception of the mining game. People see it as a money, you know, it's a perception of mining, and it's how people feel in the mining industry and what they relay to someone down the pub or at a school to how mining is.
Mining in Queensland was maybe different to what mining in WA was. And so when I graduated, I got paid $28,000 a year.
Yeah, wow.
So
what's a graduate? What
graduates now can get $100,000. So there's huge – so people have come into mining because of the money. And, yeah, sure, great. Come into mining because of the money, but also bring your passion. Become passionate about what you do, and then you'll make the big improvements. And you might even decide to stay in the industry.
Yeah, I love it personally. But I know you do too, and we can keep on going down another road there altogether. And it's – you're right. I think, unfortunately, people in our industry make decisions – too shallow these days via money. Oh, you know, mine geotech are paying this. Oh, FACE is paying this. And it's not just the people on the lower level, it's up as well. The CEOs and MDs and GMs, they're always swapping sites. And it's something that we've got to look at from, you know, one, trying to become less transient, two, make the environments more attractive and make mining more attractive in general. And people are coming into the mining who are new and having a good experience, because if they have a good experience – and we create them environments that bring the best out of them. They go out and they say, hey, like me and you, come mining, this is why. Yep, you're going to run into an odd dickhead here and there. It's wherever you go. You run into a pub, you're going to run into a dickhead. But there's a lot of other really good people. Don't let the shit people affect how you feel, and enjoy what you do, because you only get one life. And obviously you just love what you do. It's awesome talking to you, the passion you got, mate. Let's wrap it up. What's the best way of people to get hold of you, John?
Go to the website, mindgeotech.com.au.
Don't want to give your mobile number out, mate. I think it rings more than mine does.
Yeah, it's fine. Go to the website. You can email me there. You can find our phone numbers, the different offices, both in Kalgoorlie and Perth, and we can sort you out from there.
John, thanks for coming on the podcast, mate. I really appreciate your time and your input, and I'm sorry I can't get everything out of your head.
No, that's okay.
Plenty more to talk about.
Definitely.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
Bye.
John is one very smart man and has plenty to offer from a character point of view. Keep tuned on Full Production for some more quality people in the coming episodes. Next up on episode 39 of Full Production is a highlight reel of all the guests we've had on so far.